Hi, Mark Snedeker.
Hello, Christina LaRusso.
Do you know what today is?
Well, you sure do. It's Friday.
It is Friday, March 24th.
Oh, that's got to be important. Is that that one where we make the Star Wars jokes all day?
No, it's not.
Okay. Is it a Star Trek joke, possibly?
No, you know what it is because I told you. What is it?
This is the day in make-believe history when some misbehaving kids got sent to detention where they definitely deserved to be.
And they bonded.
They did bond.
And it was a film.
It was a film.
And we did a great podcast about it.
We did. There's no sense redoing it. I mean, it's the definitive Breakfast Club summary and podcast.
It was a good one. And so we are going to be re-promoting that podcast today. It is a podcast that includes our friend, Samson's mom, Andrea.
Yes.
And she added so much to the conversation. We really appreciated her. And that was, I think, maybe the first. Was that the first one that she was on?
I think so.
Or did she come back? Was that the second one? She's been with us a couple of times, though, on the podcast.
Do you find it hard to, after you say Samson's mom, to not say it's got it going on?
No, Mark, that's just you. Would you like to sing that song for her?
I'm sure she would love that.
All right. Have a listen to it. Come and talk to us on Twitter about your thoughts if you are inclined.
Yeah.
And
watch it again.
Yeah, it's a great movie. I mean, it
almost holds up.
Well, you know, it's problematic. There are some problems, and we do get into that.
We do.
There's also a Patreon episode where we explore this subject further. So if you would like to listen to that, please find us on www.patreon.com/GenXtemporaneous for $5 a month.
You can hear
all
kids.
Kinds of additional content, and we're actually going to be posting a new episode to our Patreon.
Plus, you get the full frontal nudity.
Well, there is no full frontal nudity.
Yeah, you say that.
Oh, there's Mo, though. So without further ado, let's launch into that podcast.
So really, seriously, no more ado?
None.
I had some ado lined up, but okay.
All right, everyone. We'll see you next week with a brand new episode.
Right on. I will confess something right now. Mm. I have the entire script right here on my phone.
Come on. This is so awful. Andrea, I'm sitting across from him and I see him look down and he's like scrolling madly through things. And I'm like, God, he's going to get us on textual. This is meant to be a feelings podcast, Mark.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is. This is about the Breakfast Club, my guy.
I know. And this is the script of the Breakfast Club. No, it's a pretty good resource.
I know, but we're supposed to just giving our feelings, our emotional response to it, not the...
Well, let's at least respond to the accurate text.
My God. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Gen Extemporaneous. This is a podcast where I come up with an idea, I do some research, I grab a bottle of wine, I bring everything to Mark, and he pontificates. In today's episode, Mark and I welcome a special guest, Andrea, who is going to help us launch a brand new series that we will be returning to throughout the year. We will be looking at the lessons imparted to us in popular movies from the 1970s and 80s, as well as what those films meant to us when we first saw them and how we feel about them now. The first one out of the gate is a generation-defining masterpiece, John Hughes' 1985 classic, The Breakfast Club. If you think The Breakfast Club is so problematic that it should be canceled, we are bound to disappoint you with this podcast, but we're Gen X. We got our sensitivity chips late in life, and we're still learning how to use them. Hi, Mark Snedeker.
Hello, Christina LaRusso.
Well,
before you start, I must warn you.
Yes.
If you mess with the bull, you will get the horns.
We had to warn Andrea about that before she joined us.
What, that she would get the horns?
Yeah, if she messed with the bull.
That's right.
And by bull?
I guess that's me.
So we have a special guest today.
We do.
As a matter of fact, we have recorded this episode. It is edited, and you and I are recording.
Why do you give away the secrets like this?
Well, because it's going to become evident when they hear the difference in sound when we do sound. No, it's not. When we do a remote recording, our voice sounds one way. And then the other thing is of course, Andrea is recording from her home. She was remote to us, so she's not here in the studio with us. All right, so here's something I wanted to talk about before we launch into the discussion about The Breakfast Club. I want to give a little bit of background information about it. If you haven't watched it, I don't know if you're even Gen X. So principal photography began on March 28th, 1984 and ended in May. So March, April, May, like 3 months-ish to film the movie. It took place at a vacant high school in DePlain, Illinois, called Main North High School. That location was used once again afterwards to film some of the scenes from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. The Breakfast Club went on to premiere in Los Angeles on February 7th, 1985.
The budget for this movie, $12,000.
No, and it went on to be, and it was theatrically released by Universal Pictures on February 15th, 1985. It grossed $51.5 million against a $1 million budget. In 2015, the film was digitally remastered and was rescreened in 430 theaters in celebration of its 30th anniversary. And in 2016, the film was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant.
What
I would say
honor.
All three.
What an honor.
The Breakfast Club was the first script that John Hughes wrote and asked to direct as well.
Right. And they said, well, instead of doing that, we're going to give you a few million dollars based on your no track record to make a different movie to see if you're ready to make this movie. I don't really understand that logic.
Well, we
want to make sure we don't lose money with you. So we're going to try another untested film and see if you do okay with that.
He had written a couple of movies before that, but this was the first that he was going to direct. And also he worked for National Lampoon. Magazine.
He's got some serious chops.
He's got some chops. Okay, the cast features five young actors between 16 and 25.
Yeah.
That were not super, like completely unknown, but they were not tremendously known at
right.
the time. Emilio Estevez and Ali Sheedy were probably the
Emilio
best.
Emilio was probably well known because his dad is pretty famous.
Yeah. Well, he had done The Outsiders before this. Emilio Estevez, as we were mentioning, played Andrew Clark, the jock.
The sporto.
The Anthony Michael Hall played Brian Johnson.
The brain, which is a coincidence that his name is an anagram of brain? I think not.
Maybe not. Judd Nelson plays John Bender. John Bender is the bad boy. Molly Ringwald plays Claire Standish.
I'm not even going to try an anagram with that one.
She's the princess.
She is
the popular girl. And then Ali Sheedy plays Allison Reynolds.
Yes.
They label her as the basket case,
not really that great of an appellation.
No, and probably one of the problematic things that maybe we'll get to speak about at some point here, but
I don't know what the origin of that phrase is, by the
quite,
way. A basket case.
Not quite sensitive. There are a couple of adults. Carl the janitor is played by John Capelos. He played the Bohunk boyfriend previously in 16 Candles.
Correct.
Okay, and then Paul Gleason, who plays Vice Principal Richard Vernon. I guess we're assuming that he's a vice principal. I'm not sure. Did it ever say vice principal?
No way is the principal going to be sitting there.
I know it's
Saturday.
Not the principal, but he could just be some
administrator. I can't remember if he had like his nameplate on the door or something. So.
All right. So that's basically a little bit of background. Mark, do you want to just give a quick like two-sentence description of what The Breakfast Club is about, just in case somebody hasn't seen it?
If you haven't seen it, my first advice to you is to go out and get a life. What is wrong with you?
Immediately rent it.
Go
it's on Amazon.
See the movie. All right. So five kids.
Mm-hmm.
They were bad. Got put in detention. They don't like each other for the most part. They don't know each other.
Come from totally different cliques in the high school.
That's right. And so they're isolated by the social structure of high schools in Illinois, and madness ensues.
Madness ensues. And then a makeover and everything. Everybody's happy at the end.
By the way, basket case comes from the World Wars, where soldiers who had like lost limbs and things were literally in baskets. So it's not that complimentary, and I don't know how it got to mean crazy or kind of in trouble. I guess you're in trouble if you had some limbs amputated, but that's where it came from.
So, Mark, I think what we'll do now is we will launch into our discussion with Andrea, which was a great great fun discussion.
I hope that goes well.
Hi, Andrea, and thank you for joining us. I wanted to start out by asking you to give us a hot take on
my gerb.
Yeah, she did, on the Breakfast Club.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here and talk about this movie, which is my all-time favorite movie. I think I've seen it probably 20 times, but one of the most memorable was watching it with my stepdad when I was probably 19 or 20. And trying to explain it to him from, you know, a 20-year-old's perspective to someone who was the age of the principal at the time on the movie. Mm-hmm. And I just loved how it showed the young person's view and it made them real people. Halfway through the movie, my stepdad had fallen asleep because he was bored out of his mind. He thought it was terrible. There was no action.
Nobody killed a single Nazi in this movie. What the hell?
Right. Exactly. Nothing blew up. Exactly. Right. It was not a movie for boomers. It was a movie for, you know, us Gen Xers growing up. And it just really spoke to who we were and how we dealt with high school and how we sort of organized ourselves into different sectors of the population. And it was this like one crazy day where all of them sort of came together and were able to be friends for the moment. And, you know, chaos, as we know, ensued.
You know, it's so interesting that you bring that up about your stepdad falling asleep, because it's a nice illustration of the way boomers view Gen X. We're like so invisible to them. And as a generation, Gen X typically is very ignored. Andrea, you said that this is, you know, like one of your favorite movies. And I would say that it is also one of mine. When I watch it, and we just rewatched it in preparation for this, it immediately takes me back.
Absolutely. It was weird, though, to not sort of feel the same thing for the teenagers, though. And now I was looking at it from a grown-up's point of view, and that bothered me a little bit. I found some issues with some things that happened with them.
These 80s movies, I think now, especially now when I look back, they seem to be moralizing. You're providing you with a moral lesson. So I'm wondering, which ones did you pick up on?
The thing that stood out to me the most was that the cliques aren't as special as I thought they were. The nicer kids are the ones that seem to be the non-popular ones. So when Brian and Allison talk about how they would always say hi to everybody else in the hall and consider, you know, everyone friends, when Andy and Claire said absolutely not, and John, he didn't really say anything.
Okay, then I assume Allison and I are better people than you guys, huh? Us weirdos. Would you do that to me?
No. I don't think the kind of friends I'd have would mind.
The kids you least expect to be the nice ones are the nice ones. And that would be like the goal as a young person. Like, oh, I really shouldn't worry so much about being the popular one when it's these other groups that are more real and are friendlier. And
status breeds snobbery, right?
Yes.
If you are the king of the school, you're less likely to be generous. Now, you should be. And in fact, it should be easier for you, right? But it's not. If you are the king of the school, I think it's reasonable to expect they'll be less generous and welcoming to those that they deem to be of lower status.
It's so much pressure. You don't know all the pressure.
Oh, contraire. I definitely know.
Let's talk about that, because that is something that Claire does bring up. She says,
they like, look up to us.
Well, she does say that, which is super. And she gets called out for it. Yeah. You know, like I think Brian calls her out and says, you're so arrogant. You're so conceited. I think what Claire highlights is that when you are in the popular clique or the highest status clique, whatever it is, there are expectations on you to do everything kind of the company way.
You're like full of yourself. Why are you like that?
I'm not saying that to be conceited. I hate it. I hate having to go along with everything my friends say.
Well, then why do you do it?
I don't know. You don't understand. You're not friends with the same kind of people that Annie and I are friends with. You know, you just don't understand the pressure that they can put on you.
And in this case, what she's saying is, I can't say hi to you, no matter how much I might want to, because
my friends will destroy me.
My friends will then ostracize me. Yeah. Now, especially for a woman, and we did an episode a while ago on relational aggression. And so especially for a woman, I think that that's true.
Well, I can tell a story about middle school and being in an apartment complex with like six other kids of divorced moms. And every week it was someone else's turn to be like the one on the outside. So it's a group mentality that someone always has to be the one that is breaking the rule. And you bond more when there's someone that you can all sort of together ostracize. It makes you stronger as a group. And then the next week it's somebody else's turn and you allow that person to come back in, that all is forgiven. And because it happened to you, you feel like, well, that everybody has to have their turn. So now I'm going to participate in ostracizing this other person.
Now for guys, it definitely is somewhat different, but it's not like that doesn't happen. But we used to do this thing, it was, you know, a group of four or five of us guys are all friends. And then at a predetermined signal, everybody would run away from one of them, right? We would ditch him, right?
Oh,
I know. So like, you know, if we're walking around and this kid, I knew D, it was just D-E-E. That was his whole name. If I would kind of like eyeball each other, like, okay, we're going to ditch D, go. And everybody would sprint away from him. And of course he wasn't ready for this. So he would be behind. Now I rarely got ditched, but I don't think that was because of my status. I was just faster than those guys. Like they'd be like, go. And I'd be like, yeah, what's up? Where are we going? I'm right here with you, bro. I chased you down like a cheetah on the Serengeti. And then I hamstring him and I bring him down and then I eat one of the smaller, weaker ones.
He goes right for the jugular.
I clamp my jaws around their neck. But that's a kind of the closest I got. Not that there weren't cliques in my friends. There certainly were. You know, my favorite life lesson from this movie, if you mess with the bull, you will get the horns. Look at Bender. He decided for no really compelling reason that he was going to be completely antagonistic towards Vernon, who, by the way, is a total shitheel, right? Mm-hmm. Like there are many illustrations in the movie to let us know that not only is he an authority figure, so they're going to rebel against him, but he's a dick. Mm-hmm. Dick is a dick, mm-hmm. right? He's like sneaking into the secret files downstairs, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. But for no good reason, Bender antagonizes him beyond the point even of just being a cool, rebellious kid.
You just bought yourself another Saturday, mister.
Oh, I'm crushed.
You just bought one more right there.
Well, I'm free the Saturday after that. Beyond that, I'm going to have to check my calendar.
Good, because it's going to be filled. We'll keep going. You want another one? Say the word. Just say the word. Instead of going to prison, you'll come here. Are you through?
No.
I'm doing society a favor.
So?
That's another one right now. I've got you for the rest of your natural born life if you don't watch your step. You want another one?
Yes.
You got it. You got another one right there. That's another one, pal.
Cut it out.
Do you think there was no good reason for him to antagonize?
He had justification to be angry towards him, but acting out against him just got him punished more. He had more subtle ways to do it, but at a certain point, he just lost his temper. And he couldn't figure out a way to get out of it. So he definitely messed with the bull and got the horns. You feel so horrible for Bender as you watch him just kind of spiraling.
You know what? When I watched that as a teenager, though, I didn't.
You were like, yeah, give it to him.
Give it to him. I did. I felt like, you know, like if we had that terminology, I would be like savage.
Yeah.
Right. Like I had respect right. for bucking the system the way that
Fight
he did.
Power.
Right.
Same.
Yeah.
Same. Mark, I hear what you're saying, but I think he had two things I'm thinking about. One is detention's probably better than home. So why not just have somewhere to go every Saturday to get out of the house and the hell that his house is. And two, people already decided who he was. And he didn't seem like the kind of person that would back down from that. So how could he stop himself from egging Vernon on when he kind of needed to? I mean, you could see him looking around like, well, I have to keep doing this because this is what everybody expects from me.
Sure. He wants to maintain his image as the rebel and the badass.
Right.
I would argue that all of these characters enter that library performing who they are meant to be in their high school. They aren't being necessarily authentic.
And for the most part, at least in the beginning, they seemed pretty comfortable with their roles, though.
Are they comfortable with who they are, or are they just used to having to perform that role?
I think in the beginning, they're being their authentic selves. we're the ones that are told in the beginning who they are. Had we not been read part of Brian's essay in the beginning where, you know, the roles were given to everybody, we still would have been able to figure it out. You know, Mark said that earlier, but they don't know that. So they're just coming into school, how they came into school. We saw the car or the lack of car. We saw their clothing. We saw the size of their lunch bag or what they were carrying their lunch in. So I think that they were coming as their authentic self.
You mentioned the essay that we hear at the beginning. So I'm going to read the quote because I think this will inform this portion of the discussion.
Can you do it with the Anthony Michael Hall lisp?
No, I'm not going to do that. Dear Mr. Vernon, we accept the fact that we had to sacrifice a whole Saturday in detention for whatever it was we did wrong.
What we did was wrong. But we think you're crazy to make us write an essay telling you who we think we are. What do you care? When you see us as you want to see us. In the simplest terms, the most convenient definitions. You see us as a brain, an athlete, a basket case, a princess, and a criminal. Correct? That's the way we saw each other at 7 o'clock this morning. We were brainwashed.
So answering my own question there, their brainwashing happened long ago. These roles have been set for them at some point in the past. Potentially does have to do with socioeconomic class. So this, you know, there's all kinds of different reasons. But as we see in the film, and they come to the conclusion at the end, they are all those things. Each of them has those traits.
There's certain characteristics that they had as who they really are that helped place them in these groups, right? Andrew, definitely athletic. You know, he enjoyed sports, presumably at one point in his life, at least. And he was definitely going to be a natural for that group. Claire, coming from her socioeconomic status and being the designated cute girl, is going to naturally fit into that. And she was comfortable with that for the most part. Anthony Michael Hall's character, Brian, very smart, you know, good at math, loves his demented and sad but social clubs. So he was a natural for the brain, right? Ally Sheedy, she obviously has some, she's extremely introverted and has some, you know, kind of quirky ideas about things. So I don't know how natural hers is, but they also were fighting against these stereotypes or struggling with them. They're all in the groups that seem the best natural fit for them. But the problem with them is that once you're in that group, then you're rigidly pigeonholed into that kind of person. Mm-hmm. And there's that vertical isolations between groups that only really Claire and Andy's groups interact. So I would say both. I think they're both, yes, they're more or less suited for the groups that they're in. That's how they got into those groups, but they're also struggling with the consequences of being in those groups.
You're saying that there is something inherently stereotypical about those kids.
They have inherent characteristics which determined initial placement, probably.
But the stereotype is in some way rooted in some intrinsic truth.
Well, I mean, the brains are going to be stereotypically smart. It'll be tough to get into the brains if you weren't.
But I think for the movie, it was sort of necessary. We all know these groups because we grew up with these groups. So we know them. We did this as young people, as in a need to want to make sense of our world. We organized what we saw, which, you know, back then was just high school. We didn't have the internet and social media and a phone. So our world was not that big. So all we could do is take what we saw every day and make sense of it. And, you know, as a sociology person, the way you do that is by putting things into sections and being able to understand little bites of it at a time.
People want to get into groups. You want to find people who are like you. That's a logical, that seems like a very normal human impulse, but it creates a lack of empathy for those who you deem outside of your group.
depending on which group you're in.
That's probably true, because I guess Brian and Allison would argue that they'd be nice to everybody.
But they would see the Andy and Claire characters as basically being problem free. Like, those guys have it made, you know, they're the most popular kids in the school. Yeah, we are cool to them, but we don't really, if they come to us and say, well, you know, you don't understand how hard it is, they're like, fuck you. You know, what do you have to complain about, captain of the wrestling team? You know, so I think that there's probably some level where they can't perfectly empathize with them.
But that's sort of the point of the movie. In the beginning, we're told these are the five categories of young people that you're going to see. And through the development of the movie, we blur the lines and we see where they sort of cross over into the other one. Do we see how smart Bender is? We see how insightful, you know, Allison is. And, you know, we can see where Brian wasn't as smart as he thought he was, and how Andrew has a sensitive side. So they're all of the stereotypes that we assigned to these children don't necessarily hold true. They're all human beings that have emotions and feelings. And it really is a story about how the grownups put all of this on them, is what I'm getting from the movie.
So I think that's accurate. And what you're seeing is that the group is not equal to the stereotype, right? You can be in the group of friends who are all taking AP classes. That doesn't mean that the stereotype of brains is fair or accurate.
Right.
And that's exactly what I'm talking about. Yes, it's natural for Brian to be in a group of the brains because those are the kids he has the most in common with. He has all his classes with, et cetera. That does not mean, however, that the stereotypes imposed on that group from other groups or even self-imposed, right, are fair or accurate. And that's the difference between simply having things in common and having characteristics and then being stereotyped for being in this group.
It's a setup, right? It's a setup where you have all of these cliques in the school that are now brought together with one representative in the detention. And that coming together, I think, is the thing, obviously, that breaks down their own barriers and forces them to be self-reflective. Yes. And to engage with one another. You know, once you're out of your bubble and you come into contact with others, with people that you previously didn't know, and you're interacting with them, it is impossible probably to come away from that without regaining a little bit of empathy. Because remember, as we group off, as we form into groups, we create others. And if we're in an echo chamber, we stop listening. If we either curate it ourselves or the algorithm on Google curates it for us, or on YouTube or TikTok or whatever, we only hear what we want to hear. And then when we do come across something that is different, we have no empathy for it. We have no space for it. And putting yourself into a situation where you are forced into contact with people who you might think are an other because they're a brain instead of a princess, then I think you have to start getting some empathy. You might be uncomfortable at first, and they certainly were.
I think it would be healthy if schools did more things like that, right? To try to create, not necessarily put them all in detention, right? That's not very practical, but to create situations for students to step outside of their comfort zone. You know, you can be in groups and you want to hang out with people you have things in common with, obviously, but it is healthy to break out, you know, in ways like that where you can develop some empathy for other groups. What I will say is, having a common enemy can unite a group that might not otherwise be united. Mm-hmm. Because if they didn't have Vernon, they'll just sit there the whole time and Andy will talk to Claire and, you know, Bender will go around tearing up Molière and that's it, you know, and Brian writes his lesson and eats his sandwich with his crust cut off. And they don't interact at that point, but they have a common enemy. And you know, there is no better way to unite a team than to have an other. Vernon is their other who represents mostly all adults, I would say, by working against him, sneaking out, right? You notice that even though they don't like each other, when Vernon came in and started interrogating, nobody dropped a dime on Bender.
What in God's name is going on in here? What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it. What is this? What is that? What is that? What is that noise?
Really, sir, there wasn't any noise. That noise? Was that the noise that you're talking about?
No, it wasn't.
I think that Bender would have found a way around that anyway. I think he was bound and determined once he saw the makeup of the room. Because again, I think that he was the smartest one in there, maybe the most emotionally intelligent anyway. He would have figured out a way to entertain himself by pitting everybody against each other the way he sort of did and then bringing them all together at the end. So if it wasn't Vernon, it would have been something else or someone else.
So if this is online, Bender's actually an internet troll.
Yeah, he's running around, you know.
He's an agent of chaos.
He is.
I agree with both of your assessments of that. And what I would also point out, though, from a sociological perspective, here are these people, individuals coming from each of these groups who that those groups of other people create others and they are their own self-sealing systems. So then these people are cut out from whatever their normal group is. They're in the library and then they other the adults. So they then form another group essentially against the adults. So it just seems very true to life to me because I see this play out. I mean, I see this play out all the time.
And on the internet, maybe.
Even on the internet. So, but it's true. And if you think about it, these groups undulate. It's not, it, you know, they, there's an ebb and flow in the groups. Sometimes groups will, the makeup of the group will change. Somebody will do something and get ostracized from the group. Yep. If you're put into a small group, then that group becomes your group and everybody else outside that group is outside your group. Some may be like-minded, but they still aren't your squad. Then you're in a squad.
And I would say at a certain point, if the group you're in gets too large, it begins to self-divide and then they pare that group down a little bit. And that's totally natural and organic and really horrible.
Status is such a thing.
No, I tried to tell you that early on.
All the time. So Andrea, I just had an idea. Tell me what you think of this. Was there a struggle for status within the room?
I think Bender claimed it right away when he walked in. He wasn't going to let, again, because I feel like he was the most emotionally intelligent. He could walk in, read the room, saw that there were popular kids in there and decided that he wasn't going to let them have the higher status because they all followed his lead. And to Mark's point earlier, they didn't give him up when Vernon came in and wanted to know, you know, what the ruckus was all about. So I think that, yeah, I think Bender decided he wanted it and he took it and everybody gave it to him.
I don't think Andy gave it to him.
He dropped
an ass beating on him. But you are correct in that Bender, I mean, he weathered that storm. He still was the clear leader start to finish.
Well, because Andy failed at leading.
Wait, hold it. We have to go through the cafeteria.
No, the activity's hall.
Hey, man, you don't know what you're talking about.
No, you don't know what you're talking about. No, we're through listening to you. We're going this way.
Shit! Great idea, Jagger.
Fuck you!
Fuck you! Why'd you listen to John?
We're dead.
Nah, just me. Get back to the library. Keep doing it on.
But then Bender fell on his sword.
He did.
Yes, he did.
Self-sacrificed.
Which, like a good leader.
Number one, I think that there are some people who are natural leaders. People flock to them and for whatever reason, and those leaders can be good or they can be bad. You know, I mean, I think that that's possible. But I'm also always amazed at how many people are just willing to follow.
Agreed.
Absolutely.
I like to think that I wouldn't. I'm not so sure that I wouldn't.
It would be hard for you to lead in that way, at least. I mean, not that you weren't a leader, because
Maybe I would. Maybe I would have, but it wouldn't have been the same way. That's maybe why it's not resonating with me. I don't think that I would have led by walking in and making noises and like acting wild. I would have been a quieter, but I think that I would have bent everyone to my will.
Yes, there you go. So you're more of a devious Emperor Palpatine kind of leader. Yeah,
yes. I am behind the curtain.
He's like, yes, my young apprentice.
I mostly like to be like Allison and sit in the back of the room and observe. Mm-hmm. I prefer that. So I will follow a leader if I agree with the direction. And if not, I will just do my, I'll make my own path and go on my own.
That sounds perfectly healthy.
I can't even lead my own podcast.
That's true. Who's the boss in here?
Well,
I mean, you may
only
be
because
the,
you know how to work the mixing board.
You may be the star, but who's the boss?
I don't think I'm really the star.
All right.
The queen, Mark. You need to recognize
but
that.
I think in general, okay, I'll let you characterize me. In general, do you think I'm a leader or a follower? I'm interested in your
take. God, no doubt. Mark would be Bender. He would walk in dancing, probably.
Probably dancing.
Doing some spins and being very loud and funny. So, yeah, you would definitely have tried to take over the room, but you would have been Brian, loud Brian, taking over the room, and also a smidge of Andy because you were a sporto. So, like you, I'm not saying that you were a stoner, but you would have had that big presence.
I guess. I think I'm more like that now than I was then.
I don't know you.
I hadn't fully blossomed.
Mark would have, I'm telling you, he would have entered the room. He would have had his bag of Dungeons and Dragons dice. That would be the big transgression, not running to his locker to get some drugs. Like, he would have been like, hey.
Satanic panic.
Hey, man,
anybody want to play a game of D&D?
You got a ranger? Okay.
I am the dungeon
master. I'm the dungeon master.
And then at intervals, he would just start reciting Monty Python.
Yeah, probably.
That's who you would have been.
A very nerdy leader.
Oh, my God.
The one obvious hit you in the face life lesson is don't judge a book by its cover. Right. Yes. That's the whole point of the movie. Right. It's not a very complicated message. No. It was the way he told it that was compelling and interesting. Mm-hmm. Just the don't judge a book by its cover has been the subject of 10,000 movies about especially young people. Mm-hmm. Right. Don't judge a book by its cover. You know, everybody's an individual. Respect them. Empathize, blah, blah, blah.
So let's talk about the covers of those books. Let's go through the characters and talk about the stereotype side of them first. Andrea, tell me about Claire.
Claire is the princess. She is daddy's princess. Daddy does whatever to make Claire happy. She was dressed impeccably, you know, had sushi in her little black candle bag. The whole face of makeup for Saturday detention and sat in the front. Her posture even said, you know, I'm somebody important. She sat up the whole time. She looked at everybody. And then just her demeanor by when Andy came and looked at her like, can I sit here? He asked permission. She just sort of nodded like, yeah, I guess it's okay. So yes, it was her getting out of the BMW. It was her, I can't believe you couldn't get me out of this, Daddy.
Can't believe you can't get me out of this. It's so absurd I have to be here on a Saturday. It's not like I'm a defective or anything.
I'll make it up to you.
Honey, ditching class to go shopping doesn't make you a defective. Have a good day.
Made her seem vapid. No redeeming quality in her other than she's pretty, she dresses nice, and she has status, obviously.
Her parents' financial status informs who she is.
Correct.
So a couple of things I want to just as trivia add in here. So her outfit, actually, she chose.
I picked out my outfit. I went out because originally it was supposed to be something else and it didn't quite work. And so John Hughes took me out in Chicago. We just went shopping and I picked out that whole outfit.
So I was going to say, where are those boots now and could I borrow them?
I would love to have those boots, you know, but we had to spend every day for about 3 months in the same outfit. So by the time it was finished, I wanted to have a bonfire, exactly. But I would love to have those boots now.
Even today,
you'd super wear that.
Oh,
I thought the same thing. Yeah.
Little lace scarf, you know, the boots and all the thing.
I have those.
Leather jacket.
I don't think it would take us much to get Christina to cosplay as Claire.
No, I would 100%.
The interesting thing to me about that character is what a very good actress Molly Ringwald was at that young age. Because if you think about it, she doesn't have that stereotypical prom queen look. And for her to be able to pull off that queen of the school is a testament to what a good actor she was. And obviously her wardrobe was a big part of that.
One of the things that I just also want to notice, and I don't know if either of you guys noticed this, but I found it really interesting. I noticed that as they go in, they're all bundled up in their coats and things. And as time goes on, they're peeling off layers.
Yeah.
And so it's this like, literal representation of this sort of symbolic shedding of their defenses.
Right.
Interesting.
That stuck out to me.
100% correct.
All right. So let's talk about how her... So here's the stereotype, is that she's maybe a little bit flaky, not super smart. She has this status. She's considered beautiful. She's considered important in the school.
She escapes that stereotype via trope. And the trope is good girl, bad boy. She falls for the bad boy, and that helps break her out of her social cocoon. She would never be able to socialize with him in the normal course of business. Mm-hmm. But as Bender does more of these wild antics and leads the team and fights against Vernon and all that, you can see how she's starting to admire him for doing it. Even when he's going back and forth with Andy, who's supposed to be her ally, mm-hmm. right? She's starting to smirk every time he kind of gets the best of him.
But he's horrible to her. This is, I don't like
the girl, bad boy. The girl's love that shit.
So there's the stereotype. Andrea, I'm just sitting here with waiting to talk to you about this because
I hated this part, and I didn't, he was awful to her in the beginning. And just because that's the thing, the good girl, bad boy thing, that's what happens, even though Bender's such a dickhead to her.
And I have a problem. So here's where my problem is. John Hughes was supposedly breaking down stereotypes. And this kind of comes into the problem section. We'll talk about it a little bit more in depth. But really what he's doing is he's thrusting her. She's switching a stereotype. She's always had maybe multiple stereotypes. So not only is she the stereotypical princess, but she's also a stereotypical woman. And Mark just said it, Andrea. Mm-hmm. Women love that shit.
Mm-hmm.
And that, as much as I hate to say it, there's something not wrong about what he's saying.
But the movie has a defense for that. And the defense for that is not Bender is a shitty guy. He treated her like garbage and she fell for him anyway. The movie's defense is Bender acted out the way he did because of the groups that they're in, the restrictions placed under him socially, the assumptions put on him by parents and other students. So he acted out like that. But then as you see, as the movie progresses, he becomes less and less bombastic towards her and more just kind of sarcastic. And he's not at that point, especially, you know, when they start to get a little bit romantic, he's not being shitty to her. And she's broken down that defense.
Same thing, man. Here's the thing. It's still, I agree with you. You're not wrong, but it doesn't change the fact that she's still playing right into another stereotype, which is women like bad boys. We don't like bad boys and then they stay bad boys. We like to get bad boys and fix them.
Yeah. Well,
she did.
And what that is showing is that she did. Although
she did it.
She did it.
It wasn't nice to her until she went in the closet.
I don't think that's correct. I think he had some gentler moments with her before that.
Oh, is that all it takes, Mark?
Yeah, just a couple of gentle moments that come right around.
Andrea, I'm sorry, have you met Mark?
Well, I mean, like they had a little connection there over Molière.
That's real intelligent.
You're right. It's wrong to destroy literature. It's such fun to read. And Mole really pumps my nads.
Oh, yeah.
She pronounces it for him, and then he doesn't take it badly.
See, he doesn't go, shut up.
Oh, man.
Is that all it takes? God, if I don't have known all of that.
Well, okay, it's only an hour and a half. You can only give him so much time to work these things through.
I think also him falling on his sword was more for her than any of the others. And I think that she would have, that was telegraphed to her. So I think that she saw that as, you know, like he sacrificed himself, yeah. But really this is just some kind of Harlequin romance, you know, this rakish bad boy.
Who I mean, think of him more as Han Solo, right?
Same thing. It is. That doesn't make, you're not making it better, Mark, please.
I am. Han Solo is awesome.
All right. One of the things that I saw where there was a stereotype break for Claire was particularly in that Moliere scene. Okay. So to me, that shows actually, her status, right? Her economic status, but the fact that she's not just stupid. It kind of pulled back a little peel of the onion skin for me. When she knew that, I was like, okay, she's got some cultural capital here.
Correct.
And also intelligence, because if you don't, that's not light reading.
No, nobody does that for fun. Not even French people.
The lipstick episode. I would think that would be beneath her to show everybody that little trick. Again, they were all stoned, but when she got so upset because everybody was laughing and then Bender slow clapped her at the end and, you know, Andy called him an asshole and then she cried. I wouldn't see the queen of the popular girls allowing herself to feel that much emotion from someone who allegedly is beneath her.
I agree with that. That's actually a really good point. So she's showing herself to be vulnerable. She's not, you know, she's not perfect in that moment. She's silly, which can open her up to embarrassment if people are unkind to her.
Well, and she even said that, I can't believe I'm showing you this.
Yeah, right there. And then moreover, showing her hurt. That's Claire's, transition. And then, of course, at the end, she ends up involved, at least seemingly willing to enter into some kind of relationship with Bender. Let's talk about Andy as a stereotype.
Well, so he's the stereotypical jock, mm-hmm. right? Everything is about wrestling. His whole future hinges on wrestling, right? He's got to get his ride. He's got to get his scholarship. And he hangs out with the popular sportos. And then he felt that he had to kind of be an a-hole in order to fulfill his role in that small society.
I taped Larry Lester's buns together.
That was you?
Yeah, you know?
Yeah, I know.
Well, you know how hairy he is, right? Well, when they pulled the tape off, most of his hair came off and some skin, too.
Oh, my God.
So the bizarre thing is that I did it for my old man. I tortured this poor kid because I wanted him to think that I was cool.
You see him using his athleticism to try to control his universe.
Yeah.
Right. So when Bender starts to get it, he's like, you know, the famous two hits, mm-hmm. right? I hit you, you hit the floor. And he basically uses his athleticism. It's his only tool in his toolbox at that point. Obviously, he was not in the weight cutting portion of the wrestling cycle because mm-hmm. he had like five sandwiches. But
totally typical, like teenage boy. Yeah, exactly. Hilarious.
It's like, you know what? I need some calories, bro. But he was definitely a bro. I mean, you know, he wore, and you notice that they all wear the costume of their group.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. So he wore tank top hoodie with his school team mm-hmm. on it, his letter jacket. Mm-hmm. The only tools he's using in the beginning are his social position and his athleticism. Mm-hmm. So he is all in on being an athlete mm-hmm. and he feels that he does feel like he was forced into that by his father, though.
Yeah, he's compelled to do it. Okay, so let's talk about how we see his stereotype break down. My thing was watching him show that he's thoughtful. You know, he's the one that when Allison walks away, she steps away and he comes over to her and he asks her questions. And then he says, you know, what did they do to you? Yeah. And she says, they ignore me. And at that moment, actually, when we get to Allison, that's going to be two places where like the stereotype breaks down for me, for each of the characters. His is that, you know, he's not just this unfeeling blunt instrument that goes through life wrestling with guys.
Yeah.
He's, or fighting or whatever, trying to find a girl to fuck. He's actually got a sensitive, thoughtful side. I think I give him a few more emotional intelligence maybe than either of you do.
I agree with you there. That was a poignant scene where he agreed. He didn't say a lot, but you could see the emotion and the recognition of how she was feeling on his face. I guess maybe the other one was when she came out after the makeover and his whole demeanor sort of softened. Mm-hmm. That was sort of breaking down a little bit too, how he could be, his edges could soften a little bit. Cause you're right. He did just sort of walk through life like a blunt instrument. That's a very good description of him. I related, I guess, less to him than any of the others. So I have a hard time giving him any empathy as far as what he went through, other than to know that the pressure that he was under must have been tremendous.
For me, the big one is, of course, when he shows remorse for taping Larry's buns together, mm-hmm. where he basically says, you know, the kid didn't do anything to me.
And I started thinking about my father and his attitude about weakness. And the next thing I knew, I jumped on top of him and started wailing on him. And my friends, they just laughed and cheered me on. And afterwards, when I was sitting in Vernon's office, all I could think about was Larry's father. And Larry having to go home and explain what happened to him. And the humiliation, fucking humiliation he must have felt. It must have been unreal. How do you apologize for something like that?
To me, that was the big breakdown where he was showing regret.
I disagree. I think all he was feeling in that moment was, if that happened to me, how pissed off or how disappointed my dad would have been.
Yeah,
that's what empathy is.
But he didn't try to be Larry and see what Larry's dad. He thought about, if I ever disappoint my dad, I don't think that's empathy. I think that's selfish. I think he just said, God, I never want to be Larry. There's nothing, I wouldn't want my dad to look at me the way Larry's dad must be looking at him.
I agree with Mark that's a moment where his stereotype is meant to be breaking down, right? You're supposed to see this sensitive side and this thoughtful side. And as I said, I do believe that exists in him. I also agree with you that was a lot of projection and is really telling me a story more about what Andrew thinks Larry's dad would do,
right,
based on what his dad would do.
Right.
What he didn't take into consideration is that, and I don't know that this is true, but Larry's father may not have been ashamed of him. He may have just been concerned for him and caring for him. Of course, this is Gen X, so maybe not, but.
Right. Did you die? Then fine. Go do your homework.
Rub some dirt on it. Move on.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, as I was watching and I thought, it is still, though, for me, that still is a stereotype breaking moment, because even though he's projecting what he thinks his dad would do, and he may not be correct about what Larry's dad would do, he is sharing his lived experience with an overbearing father who's putting, you know, a lot of pressure on Andrew to be the way he wants Andrew to be.
He's clearly saying that poor kid, all his only crime was that he was weaker than me. Right.
Yeah.
Which is factually correct.
Right.
And he did it because he thought his dad would want him to. He just had the feeling that his dad was kind of disappointed. He never, as he says, cut loose on somebody. But he did say, all I could think about was Larry's father and Larry having to go home and explain what happened to him and the humiliation.
But he's assuming that the father would be humiliated over Larry. He's in that statement to me, I was
very, kid,
you know, I'm with you.
Let's do Alice. Let's do Allison now. So the stereotype for Allison is that she's the basket case, kind of the outsider. She's a weird, keeps to herself, super introverted. People would have probably mocked her for her clothes. That's the kind of person that she would be. And she just doesn't really even have any friends. She's not really having that, what you would hope to be a kind of a traditional high school experience where there's, you know, a big sort, some kind of social thing. She just has none of that.
She's not even in the math club.
She's not in anything. She just sits back and she's very observant though. So she's sort of like, she's just watching them. And I think for the first 25 minutes or so of the film, she doesn't even speak. I go back and forth on who I think has the most depth of emotion and the ability to, I mean, I know we've said that Bender is. I think that Allison is too. Because of her distance, she can see things more clearly, maybe a little bit than the others. But also she's like kind of a wacko. She does like kind of wild things. Like she made
pathological a pixie stick liar. Sandwich.
She makes a strange sandwich. She's just strange. And she really leans into that strangeness.
Yeah. I love how she takes everything. That just cracked me up this time. Because as a teenager, I wanted to be Claire. And as a grown up, I want to be Allison.
No, right. Exactly. So where do we see Allison's stereotype breakdown?
I guess it starts when she and Andrew go to get the drinks. She starts testing to see how far she can get. Mm-hmm. Right? So she goes from not talking at all to I'm going to see how, like, what kind of crazy statements I can say that are just going to like fuck with everybody. Mm-hmm. So she starts seeing, I think, first if she can break everybody else down before they break her. And then the whole conversation about sex so that she could get Claire to come clean. And then she came clean.
Have you ever done it with a normal person?
Didn't we already cover this?
You never answered the question.
Look, I'm not going to discuss my private life with total strangers.
It's kind of a double-edged sword, isn't it?
A what?
Well, if you say you haven't, you're a prude. If you say you have, you're a slut. It's a trap. You want to, but you can't. Then when you do, you wish you didn't, right? Or are you a tease?
Well, you're a tease and you know it. All girls are teases.
She's only a tease if what she does gets you hot.
I don't do anything.
That's why you're a tease.
No, doesn't it bother you to sleep around without being in love? I mean, don't you want any respect?
I don't screw to get respect. That's the difference between you and me.
Obviously, the big one is her conversation with Andrew off on the side where she admits that her parents ignore her, which I felt deep down into my soul.
We can say this in retrospect,
yes.
But maybe Generation X is the Allison of the generation. Because, you know, we're ignored a lot.
Right. Well, the whole sandwich, like, you know, everybody else, obviously their mom packed their food. I mean, Brian didn't have any, I'm not Brian, John had no food. He just stole Brian's, but you know, she went obviously in the pantry in the morning and said, what do I want? I want bread. I want pixie sticks and I want a bag of Captain Crunch and I'll figure it out later.
Solid meal.
It is.
Exactly.
She had pimento loaf. And then she
threw it up on them. Was it pimento or olive? You're right. That's
olive.
What I thought
it was
too.
Olive loaf.
Well, I can tell you.
Is anybody that's not Gen X going to know what this horrific looking piece of meat?
I can tell you from years of cereal box reading experience that at least she had plenty of riboflavin that day.
Oh man, and you know that the roof of her mouth was torn up from that Captain Crunch.
Yes. Well, and the pixie sticks didn't help that much either. So.
No, or the Coke. Then she put the pixie sticks in her Coca-Cola.
That scene, she improvised a lot of that. Yeah, she's the one that came up with the idea that she was going to put Captain Crunch in it. And she said she wanted that because she imagined Allison wanting to be able to make noise and having that.
She loves smashing down the Captain Crunch.
Right. And the funny thing is that when she did the first take of it, like all the rest of the cast cracked up because she just took this big bite and then she's like crunching and making this funny face. And John Hughes, this is different than a lot of films, and when films are produced, I read that he would keep everyone there for reaction shots, even if they weren't being filmed that day. So they might be filming just Ali Sheedy that day, but he would have all of the rest of the cast there to give reactions. And usually my understanding is that that's not necessarily the case.
Right.
Brian.
Oh, sweet Brian.
The emotional beating heart of the whole thing. Oh, very sensitive. Okay.
All right. As the nerd, the dweeb, the brain, whatever you want to call him, you know, his pants were too short. They were too high. He was awkward. had braces and yes, very obviously the smart one. My thing with him that I loved the most though was when he would get nervous and would have verbal vomit.
Mm-hmm.
And he just kept like saying stuff that meant nothing to anybody, but that was very endearing to me for some reason.
Is there a breakdown of his stereotype?
First of all, they were all amazing actors, but the scene when they got high and he put the glasses on,
mm-hmm.
he did that whole accent. That was a little bit of a breakdown. That was a little anti-Brian right there.
Mm-hmm. Chicks cannot hold their smoke. That's what it is.
You know, him loosening up a little bit, him dancing, also loosening up a little bit, him being the DJ.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever think that, you know, the nerd would be able to pick out music that everybody would dance to? Mm-hmm. The fact that he got high at all. But then, of course, you know, the whole conversation of why he did what he did, why he was there. And then the asking of everyone whether they would be friends with him mm-hmm. on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Was the biggest peel, was the biggest heartbreak of all of it. And
he probably changed the least.
Yeah.
And he was also the least problematic.
Well, I mean, he was in there because he was failing shop and he brought a gun to school. Right. It was a flare gun, yeah. Which, you know, obviously, but
he had serious emotional difficulties. But in terms of his behavior towards the others, he was probably the least problematic. Although you could say that he may have held stereotypical views of, you know, some of the other four kids.
Well, but the brains generally, I wonder if they would have thought the rest of the people were just kind of not very bright.
Well, I mean, you should find one and interview them.
Oh my God. Which, Mark, you display every day on Twitter.
My disdain for those who are not
for those you
me.
Determine. You define.
I do.
Yeah. Okay. So, I agree, though. I think that he changes the least. And I think that he is, I mean, he continues to be himself in many ways. I think that he is the one that is maybe most in touch with himself. And I still feel that I feel the same way about Allison. Mm-hmm. And the only reason that I say Allison didn't really break her stereotype is because she let someone change her.
Mm-hmm. But she did embrace it to a certain extent.
I mean,
right?
Yeah, but also, she liked that black shit
yeah.
around right. her eyes.
That's like what that. I was thinking too. Yeah, that's
you know,
great.
So yeah. So she essentially would something she chastised to Andrew. Yeah. You do yeah. everything that everybody tells you to do, and that's a problem.
Yeah.
And in the end, she did what Claire told her to do.
But it was
she saw it as a kindness.
Allison, I feel that, Mark. I agree.
Well, she says
her.
It. She says, "Why are you being so nice to me?
Yeah, because you're letting me."
Then, so then I guess Bender is our last one.
Does he ever get emotional or not emotional? I feel like he came in like a tornado and pretty much let it all out there. The only time I think he broke his stereotype was the surprise that he had when Claire came to him and kissed him first. If you call that a kiss, I think he was genuinely shocked by that.
So because his stereotype is that he's this kind of bad boy that Mark described before. And, you know, kind of not a very faithful guy, not a one woman
right.
man. You know, he has that wallet full of pictures of women, of girls.
He doesn't throw anything away, just like she doesn't. Right.
Right. Right. And he's, you know, and he's aggressive and he's angry. And
but he was completely self-centric, right? He was all about Bender.
Right.
Until the battle with Vernon got to a certain point and then he fell on his sword. That's when he did something for the group. You can argue that he did it just for Claire, but that's fine too. That's where he broke out of just being, you know, angry and bellicose to keep people at a distance, only acting in his own, you know, on his own whims and his own, you know, best interest, whatever, until he took one for the team.
But why?
That's where I think.
Why did he do that? If it wasn't for Claire.
Well, it could have been for Claire, but he was doing something for somebody else in that group where he was openly antagonistic towards that entire group until
what was the shift for him, do you think?
I think he just started to, I mean, they had spent this day together and they started to bond. You know, they danced, they had weed, you know, they have a common enemy. And he started to feel a bond towards the group, even though he wouldn't, you know, admit that out in the open, mm-hmm. right? Like, I really love you guys, you know, whatever. He would never do that, right? Mm-hmm. But he did show that in that way. He had a little moment with Andy, gave him the glasses for better hallway vision. They bonded over it, and now he feels some level of kinship with this group.
The guys bond in a traumatic situation, and the girls bond over makeup.
Again, vapid.
Yeah. And I didn't catch that until we're having this conversation. That's why I love having these conversations. I think that he starts breaking down. I think you see a little bit of it, but it's very subtle and it's in his acting. When he challenges Vernon and he ends up getting all of those detentions, the character is showing something. And if you're watching him, you understand like this belligerence, this has got to be coming from somewhere. There's something in Judd Nelson's eyes. He was very good as Bender. Oh, yeah. And I could also see him intellectualizing his emotions. Now, maybe I'm not saying this right. Let me describe what I'm talking about. And then you guys tell me if intellectualizing his emotions is correct. So he at the end says to Claire, who is one of her issues is that her parents are on the verge of divorce, a very 80s problem. And she has said earlier in the film that her parents use her against each other. Mm-hmm. And so then he said at the end,
you know how you said before how your parents use you to get back at each other? Wouldn't I be outstanding in that capacity?
What I see him doing there is taking his feeling, which is I think that he really cares for her or wants to care for her, or at least wants to get to know her. And instead of just being like, I'd really like to spend time with you, he wraps it up in this intellectual way, which is let's use me to get back at your parents. And you know, then he's a little bit protected emotionally because he's putting it all into this very, it's a cerebral thing more than a heart thing.
But he's giving her a rationale to be able to justify being with him.
Yeah. So he was there because he pulled the fire alarm. Yeah. In the
pretty
school.
Pretty tame prank given his
right
locker with a guillotine. I
know. You know, one of the other ways he's breaking his stereotype is breaking down when he talks about his parents. There again, that's real raw emotion that this character is expressing. And Judd Nelson does such a good job with it.
That's bullshit. It's all part of your image. I don't believe a word of it.
You don't believe me?
No.
No?
Did I stutter?
You believe this? It's about the size of a cigar. Do I stutter? See, this is what you get in my house when you spill paint in the garage.
Right.
So we know what Bender's arc is. I can't re-experience it for the first time, but there's a possibility that early on, before he starts peeling away those layers, you really do think he's just a dick, like with no reason. There's no motivation. Sure. That gives us then as an audience a reason to be like, well, he's not just a dick. There's a reason for this behavior. And he is redeemable if only he has the right princess with diamond earrings. The portrayals of the teens in this film have been critically lauded. They say, you know, this is the first time really that a movie really captured what it was like to be a teen without there being like the obligatory, you know,
no boobs,
sex scene, no, or shower scene. Do you know that there was supposed to be a nude scene in the Breakfast Club? Yes.
Who originally was gonna be nude?
There was going to be synchronized swim. No, get this. It was supposed to be that there was a synchronized swimming routine for the synchronized swimmers, but they swam nude on their practices on Saturdays. And Vernon was supposed to come across this.
What the hell?
I know.
That was a wise thing to leave on the cutting room floor.
So why?
All of a sudden, it's like, oh, we have this very thoughtful teen exploration, and now we're Porky's.
I was just going to say, and here we are in Porky's. How realistic here are the adults? Carl, the janitor, and Vice Principal Vernon.
As I watched it again today, I sort of feel like they are a caricature of what young people see grownups being like. You take every crappy teacher, principal, authoritarian person and mash them all together and you have Vernon. Dick, as Mark so eloquently named him, was exactly that.
Carl was man of the year.
Well, I'm not sure Carl.
What he was man of the year for, but you, as you pan in the original and like in the early part of the movie, and you see this award with Carl with hair, right?
Mm-hmm.
It says Carl, whatever, man of the year. But he will tell you more about Vernon than almost anybody, what he is. He's like, you just thought it was going to be a cool job. Summer's off. You know, he's got Vernon figured out and gets $50 out of him.
Yeah, so. Because Vernon is a bad guy. Like Vernon is a bad guy.
He's legitimately a bad guy. He doesn't like children, right? Nope. He has no love for the educational system. He's like Carl said, he said, you thought it would be a cool job, right? Mm-hmm. And now he's just kind of like, you know, marking time until he gets to retire and wielding whatever petty little power he has over his fiefdom.
Okay. So
one of the best things that they did for him was make his shoes squeaky.
Mm-hmm.
That was perfection to add to his crappy demeanor. And the way he spoke to children as a grown-up, now that I'm watching it, I was just like, it was shocking to me.
He tries to egg Bender into an altercation.
But someday, man, someday, when you're out of here and you've forgotten all about this place and they've forgotten all about you and you're wrapped up in your own pathetic life, I'm going to be there and I'm going to kick the living shit out of you, man. I'm going to knock your dick in the dirt.
You threatening me?
You think anybody is going to take your word over mine? Come on. Get on your feet, pal. Let's find out how tough you are. I want to know right now how tough you are. Come on. I'll give you the first punch. Let's go. Come on.
He, though, is definitely the big bad. And we are all meant to not like him.
Yeah.
And so we are a part of the Breakfast Club.
And who, there is no, other this he has guy. No redeeming quality.
The adults are not meant to have their stereotype unwound. We're not meant to see any kind of character arc. They are just who they are.
Right.
They're very monolithic. I am wondering if any of us can see any elements. Is there any humanity in him?
He has no redeeming qualities.
Obviously, since I asked this question, I have something in mind. So let me throw this out here. What about the fact that doesn't he say at some point when he's talking to Carl, the kids I don't get these kids anymore, or the kids hate me now, or whatever. It seems to me that there's something about, you know, you're cool with kids for a while and you can hang in there up to a certain age. And then all of a sudden it tips over and the chasm between the generations is too broad for any real connection. So I wonder if he's past that point now, like where in the beginning, when he was a young, cool teacher, he was still kind of, you know, he could still vibe with the kids he was teaching. Now he just can't. They're completely foreign to him.
Because he refuses to change.
He does refuse to change, but
I think it's really more of the back in my day fallacy, right? Like where he realizes where he is now and these kids all hate him. So it must be the kids, right?
Yeah.
Can't be him.
Right.
So he's like, you know, kids today, now I just don't get them.
Yeah.
I don't think he ever got them.
Well, you know, and he's in a position. Yeah, maybe you guys are right. He's in a position where he's a vice principal, got to work the detention on Saturday. There's some resentment there. You know, you can see he's got that squeaky shoe. His clothes are weird. Like, I don't know if I see vulnerability in him at all. I'd like to think that there is, but maybe not. Maybe I mean, I'm just always
think
trying
about
to...
him when he's alone. Did he show any vulnerability?
He was acting like a nitwit.
He was looking at himself in the mirror. He's like doing karate poses or whatever.
That's true. Yeah, he's not.
So in the dark night of his soul, on the lonely desert that he inhabits, he was still a douchebag.
Yeah, he is. He's living his karma. Okay, Carl. What do you guys think of Carl? He's the janitor.
Well, he does illustrate a little bit of the don't judge a book by its cover, right? Because he's like, you know, you look down on me.
You guys think I'm just some untouchable peasant, sir? Peon, you know? Maybe so. Falling a broom around after shitheads like you for the last 8 years, I've learned a couple of things. I looked through your letters, looked through your lockers. I listened to your conversations. You don't know that, but I do. I am the eyes and ears of this institution, my friends.
He's a little bit the Greek chorus.
Yeah.
Right. And they try to mock him and he doesn't really let it get to him. Mm-hmm. You know, he's like, whatever. I'm a janitor now. That's just that's my job.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. But he doesn't let him be intimidated by Vernon. Right. Mm-hmm. And he calls him out on his bullshit. So he's a little bit the Greek chorus
There also isn't anything wrong with being a janitor.
Correct.
Okay, so now here's a quote from Ally Sheedy's Allison. She says, when you grow up, your heart dies. Do we agree or not?
I think it's extreme to say your heart dies. You definitely do change, obviously. Mm-hmm. You have different responsibilities. You have a different life. It's fair to at least say that we do often lose something from childhood that may be worth hanging on to.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's not necessarily your heart, but I suppose that was the best descriptor for 16-year-old, 17-year-old. I agree with Mark insofar as your responsibilities change and you can't spend hours upon hours doodling in your room and imagining what life is going to be like and daydreaming and creating in your mind the life that you want when you grow up. Like at some point you would just have to choose it and decide. And there is a certain death of childhood that has to happen or else you don't eat and you don't have electricity in your house. And
I don't know. I think that it's to do with hope. You know, you always have hope, but sort of at a certain point, your life kind of gets fixed. You get into whatever the rhythm of your life is. And I think that's what you described so nicely there, Andrea.
But like you always talk about, like how I'll walk into a place and I'll be dancing or...
Mark, you are filled with whimsy.
I am. And you always... But see, I'm not sure you know who I am.
No, I do know who
you're
you
like,
are.
You're full of whimsy, but then you go, ugh, your scientific viewpoint has no magic in your life.
I'm starting to see just like in the Breakfast Club, layers are coming off.
Do you guys know the Puff the Magic Dragon song?
Yes.
So just like Jackie Paper had to put away the dragon at a certain point, it's the same thing, right? He had to put away his toys and grow up.
Well, I mean, you have to, and there is some poignancy in that. There is poignancy in aging, you know, growing up and getting into the next part of your life cycle. Yeah. But then there's also wonderful things that come with that. And one of the worst, though, is having to plan something to eat every night and laundry.
And make it for other people.
Let's talk about some of the problematic aspects of this film. And so one of the things that I want to talk about is the sort of casual homophobia that was in this film.
I hadn't seen the movie in a while, so I've forgotten that part. And well, I can't say I was shocked by it, but I was taken aback to hear that word twice. And I don't know if I'm being dismissive when I say that it was 1985. And that's sort of the shit that we said back then. Even I probably used, maybe not 1985, but in the late 70s, early 80s, I probably said that word a dozen times, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But it is problematic but it is indicative of what was happening in that particular group of very white, very straight people. Right. That would have been a term that was bantered around probably all towards Brian. Brian probably heard that term, you know, wielded against him many, many, many times, I'm sure.
Well, and interestingly, I don't know if you all caught this, but there's some mild teasing, an attack on masculinity when they talk about Andrew wrestling in tights.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Yeah. Basically says you're gay.
Yeah. Like that's very girly.
And that was the ultimate insult back then, which is horrible. Yeah.
Of course.
But it was very common. And it is shocking sometimes. I mean, I know we've gone back and watched a couple of things from the '80s and you see that just very casual, not just homophobia, but especially homophobia probably, mm-hmm. but racism and sexism and all those mm-hmm. things that today, at least if you're, you know, of a certain mind are going to be more shocking to you. But yeah, it's just so casual. Like if someone had said, if he had had the N-word on his locker, even that would have shocked people back then.
Oh, for sure.
Right.
Right.
You know, having what he had on his locker, it just didn't even register. We forgot that it was in it, right?
Right.
You forget that it was even in there.
Through time, it became understood that it was not politically correct anymore to use the N-word. That would have been a shock even then to see that. Now, misogyny and homophobia in full effect.
Oh, certainly. Yeah.
Exactly. I think the AIDS crisis was probably just beginning. You know, sadly, we have experienced people not much older than that still using that word today, not that long ago. So, you know, I want to say when you know better, you do better. And we have come a very long way since then and have learned that there are better insults to use than that particular word. But, you know, we're not there yet. But
like
I don't
weapons grade plum.
That's one of my favorites.
I mean, I have a number of friends I went to college with who, you know, and weren't out at the time. But, you know, now I know we're gay.
Yeah.
And you think back, you're like, holy shit, what did I say? Horrible things that I say casually in front of them. Now, I was never a big proponent of the F word.
Well, it was such a descriptor.
Well, and it was the one thing that men feared above all else was for people to think they were gay, which is terrible, but that's true. If like that, and that's why Bender attacked Andrew in that way, because he knew that the biggest fear he probably has is being seen as either weak or gay.
And it's hard to realize that wasn't really that long ago. And it was part of our upbringing. You know, hopefully as we matured and our heart died, we got smart and tried to educate people and realized that wasn't the greatest word to use. The insults that were used there. And you know, I had other ones slung at me in those years. That was just sort of the way it was.
One of the other points that was, I mean, clearly problematic is the lack of diversity in terms of anything different than white.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, there's nothing different than it's like white. If the majority is male, there's no other sexuality than straight, except as an insult.
Right.
And I wonder how he would have even handled that, because back then he would have had to have addressed it. And that's not what his movie was about, was not about race. And this is not an excuse. I mean, you should have just been able to handle it like it was just another character. But I think he would have felt back then that they would have had to deal with, let's say they had a black character, that they would have then had to make his blackness part of that discussion. I don't know that he would have the vocabulary for that.
No, only to mock, I think, honestly, because John, of course, this is outside of this film, but in 16 Candles is one of the worst racial stereotypes.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yes, that's what I was thinking too. Yeah. Exactly.
So I'm wondering how much of it Long is just, it, yeah. I'm wondering how much of this is a John Hughes thing. Not, you know, look, he's a boomer. He comes from that generation. This is the, you know, and yes, he was placing it in Gen X and Gen X was playing it, but really it was him. I mean, it was him and his, like his, who he thought he would.
But if I think back on
we laughed at it. We laughed at that scene in 16 Candles, right? Along with just like we were supposed to. We were good little moviegoers and thought it was funny because like,
remember that time he said, "No more Yankee the Wanky." Wasn't that amazing?
Yeah. Well,
no, it's not really amazing. Yeah. And again, it doesn't let them off the hook for it. But it was the time. And it really does point out how terrible we were about that back
then. Right. How wrong we were. Exactly. But we're here now. And that's the important part, that we can go back and say, oh, wow. Okay. Well, that was wrong. You know, and we can do better. And that's the only way we're ever going to learn, is to go back and point out what we did that was not great and try and do it differently and better.
Because, you know, here's the obvious question is, well, do you cancel the Breakfast Club because it's got these issues, and including, you know, misogyny and you know, sexual harassment, like rampant sexual harassment.
I mean, I'm not 100% sure, but I don't think you're permitted to stick your face between a girl's legs without her permission.
They actually had to use a body double.
They used a stunt double for the underwear.
For her, because she was 16 and he was 25. Yeah. So at least they had that. Yeah. Thank God.
Yeah. Otherwise, Judd would have some questions to answer. You don't cancel it, but you deal with it kind of in the way that Disney did in a few of theirs, where they said, look, we're going to keep this movie up because people love this movie or whatever, but we're going to tell you there's some inappropriate stereotyping that goes on in this, and everyone should be aware of that. You know, it's not okay for people to stereotype.
I think you have to use it as an opportunity to show, like to educate. Andrea, you said that you were talking to a friend before this about where are they now?
I will go to the easiest one first.
Okay.
Who do you think that is? Brian.
Brian. I was going to say, yeah.
For sure.
I'm billionaire.
Exactly. Mail order Russian bride, super happy, super hot, got the world on a string.
Because he was smart.
It would be a lot to expect Bender to overcome his upbringing, his family life. Because look, he is in an abusive family, and it's not even just the cigar thing. His dad is obviously abusing his mother, right? Because he does that little reenactment where he has him, you know, bitch, go get me a turkey pot pie, mm-hmm. and then pow, mm-hmm. you know, right to the moon, Alice type of thing. Mm-hmm. I think it would be very difficult, and maybe, you know, it's possible that Claire pulls him out of that, but I don't know that that's realistic. I think that Bender would be kind of more likely to have a tougher life ahead of him.
I'm going to do Claire.
Okay.
And I'm going to say that it would for her also be too hard to break out of where she's already situated.
Yeah.
She tips her hand to that when they're having the talk, and she says, I honestly won't talk to you guys. Yeah. So they walk out looking like they're friends. I'm not convinced that Claire does follow through.
She really values her position. Obviously her socioeconomic status is fixed somewhat. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's a reasonable, I mean, it's a cynical, but it's a reasonable position. Now, she does say that before she decides to get together with Bender.
I know she does. And I think that in the moment, this feels good to her.
Right.
But I don't know how much courage of conviction
she has. Is she walking down the hall with Bender arm in arm?
I don't know.
Sneaky links. They're sneaky links.
That could be. Or she could do a makeover on Bender. So then it's, you know, part two of Breakfast Club. He's all that. Do Allison.
She works for like a social work agency somewhere. Mm-hmm. She moved to Oregon and she drives a Subaru. And she's definitely a lesbian.
Definitely. She definitely is.
Definitely.
I 100% agree with that. I agree with that because she had it all except for the Subaru, I think. Probably not. I mean, and also she was portrayed as a straight character in the movie. But
well, as far as you know, that's maybe true. She's just, you know.
Yeah. You never know. What's that?
She could be pansexual, bisexual. Yeah. All sexual.
You never know what it is. But yeah, I do agree. I agree with you. That's the life that I would like to see her have, because she's, you know, and I think that then she would find her people, because she says, you know, she's really a loner and she doesn't have friends. And I think maybe finding who and following her true path. And I think that she would be the one most capable of it.
Yes.
All right, Andrea, I think we're going to wrap up here.
I had an awesome time. Thank you very much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
You may never hear the part where I yelled at Christina.
I'll leave that as a thing.
I will know it was there.
Okay, Mark. Well, that was a really interesting conversation with Andrea. I had a lot of fun. Did you have fun?
I had the best time.
It was nice to have Andrea help me gang up on you.
Yeah, well, you were both wrong on various points. So bring as many people as you like. I don't care. I'll still be right at the end of the day.
You were incorrect. But what it does prove is that Mark is dedicated more to being right than to being happy.
That's right. Fucking yay.
All right. Well, thank you all for coming to listen to us each week. We really appreciate it. Mark and I are now going to record a little bit of an extended conversation about the Breakfast Club. That is going to be on our Patreon. If you would like to follow us on Patreon, please come and find us at patreon.com/GenXtemporaneous.
It's only $5.
$5 a month will get you a slew of additional content. All right, Mark. Well, I think that's going to be it. I'm just going to say bye.
Peace out, Cub Scout.
Wow.
Anything that wasn't nailed down, she just would sort of like get in a scene and grab it. Like the knife that Bender puts on the table near her. She takes a lock off of his locker. She takes Andrew's patch off of his jacket. And
she's a magpie.
Yeah, she is. She took Brian's wallet. Which sets up one of the funniest jokes in the whole movie, which is Andrew goes,
"This is the worst fake ID I've ever seen." You realize you made yourself 68?
Oh, I know, I know. I goofed it.
What do you need a fake ID for?
So I can vote.
To vote.
Right.
By the way, voter fraud is a very serious felony offense.
Yeah, John Hughes.